It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up, we discuss a new UW project that will help identify the remains of Americans' fallen soldiers in wars going back to World War II. First, the president of soccer organization FIFA officially resigned this week, less than a week after he was re-elected to the post as the head of soccer's governing organization. The resignation came during a huge corruption scandal. Last Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Justice indicted 14 men, over half of them FIFA officials, for corruption over a period of two decades. Swiss authorities arrested seven of them in Zurich at the request of the U.S. Andre Markowitz is here with us to explain the scandal. He's a professor of political science and German studies at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. He's the co-author of books including Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, along with Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in your writing, you made an analogy, something like FIFA is to soccer as the Vatican hierarchy is to Catholicism. How important is FIFA in the soccer world?
Well, it's all important and not important. Let me start with the second. This whole thing is predicated on the total sort of love for and the attraction of this game. This Saturday, Juventus Turin and Barcelona will play for the Champions League at the Champions League final in Berlin, which will be watched probably by about a billion people. Trust me, not one of those billion people will ever kind of worry about, oh, you know, there's actually an organization lording all over this match and over everything soccer where folks are not exactly sort of straight and have really made hundreds of millions of dollars. So you have to separate the two, but the reason that FIFA and the officials could be so corrupt is precisely because they're a monopoly, precisely because they're lording over a public good, which is, what economists would say, perfectly price inelastic, meaning regardless of who it's run by, people will watch it and want to consume it. And precisely because everybody wants to be the host of these rare occasions like the World Cup, that's why you have unbelievable corruption. You don't have corruption for the World Championship in the shot put or the discus or virtually all the other things that are basically the Olympic sport, but you do in this. And so there are two levels here that one has to look at. And clearly FIFA, since 1904, its founding in Paris, has been the sole jurisdictional body of what is association football, called football by much of the world, but soccer, which is a shortened British slang term, by Americans, Australians, and various other folks.
Now, for people, Andy, who have just been watching the headlines here, what's the nature of the corruption we're talking about that led to all these charges that are at the heart of this scandal?
Well, it's precisely due to the unbelievable desirability of hosting World Cups and other tournaments that you had massive payola of officials to vote for certain countries to host these things. And in this context, you had people whose votes were bought by various actors, precisely because what they offered, namely the venues for these important events, was so dear to billions of people. And this corruption has gone on for decades and decades. This is nothing new. There have been books on this. I could fill up my entire library with, in German, in all kind of BBC, all kinds of things, where, in fact, you see this corruption, and this was known to all. But now it's for the first time, basically, a state power has intervened. And the reason that the United States intervened here is because American banks were used, because, in fact, an American guy who was a very, very high up in something called CONCACAF, which is our, which is the region that includes the United States. It's basically all of North America plus Central America, Mexico, Honduras, and so on. In there, there was actually a guy who was deeply, deeply corrupt, an American by the name of Chuck Blazer, who has now started to speak and started to spill the goods. And this, among others, has started a whole thing which leads clearly up to possibly Mr. Blatter.
Talking to Andy Markovitz about the ongoing scandal in the soccer or football world surrounding FIFA, the big international soccer organization. Is anything going to change? These big charges, unprecedented in ways, coming from the United States. Is this going to change the nature of FIFA and the way the money is managed in the world of soccer?
That's a very good question to which I don't have the answer, but there's no question also that this is a major watershed. How it will play out, I have no idea. Let's talk again in a couple of months. I, in a piece in the Huffington Post, have argued, and which is picked up in Europe and so on, that UEFA, which is by far and away the most powerful and strongest federation, the European Union of Football Association, just split. The reason why you couldn't split, and that's very important for your listeners to understand, is that were you to, I mean, the European countries or the Champions League does not need FIFA. Real Madrid, Barcelona, Manchester United, and Bayern do not need FIFA. They can play on their own. But the minute they were to do this in the old regime, FIFA would declare them outlaws. And in fact, all the clubs and above all, also their players would actually not be playing soccer. It would actually be something else. And above all, and this is the most important thing, in the world of soccer, since its beginning in 1872, there are two sort of tracks that are equally important to every player, club and country. And as long as it's important for Lionel Messi and for Ronaldo to play for Argentina and Portugal, respectively, as long as that is the case, and since the country games are completely controlled by FIFA, the clubs actually cannot split because their players would not be allowed to play for their country, and this matters to them. If, in fact, it would not matter to them, FIFA's magic would be over in 1 second. Now, how this will play out is unclear. I think there is a chance that UEFA might split, which will mean that there's total chaos, that there would, in fact, be rival global organizations. It's unlikely. I think it should, but for that I don't have time in these few minutes that you allow me to argue why it should do this. So I think it's an open thing, totally unexpected, and really a watershed. This is something completely new.
Andy, as we wrap up, the money is there, and that's not going to go away. You say so many people love the game. There's going to be money, but people point toward transparency. FIFA is this inscrutable black box. We don't know how these decisions are going to be made. Could there be transparency reforms that take some of the corruption out so we at least can follow the money and it goes legally?
Look. As I said before, who asks for transparency? I'm not going to ask for transparency this Saturday when I watch this great game. I don't watch transparency when I'm following my beloved Manchester United. People, there's a two, and that's, and the FIFA people know this. So, in fact, yes, there is kind of a demand sort of on a higher, more or kind of ethereal level that this should be run like a, you know, clean democracy, whatever. But ultimately, as long as what really matters to the billions of fans is the game itself, I don't think that we really will demand for that to happen. Again, if it's a monopoly, and of course an uncontrolled one, I really believe in structures that lead to these, are just very conducive to corruption. I don't think that these guys are particularly evil in and of themselves. They're not. But because The good is so desired, and everything around it is so desired. Who is hosting the World Cup, or who is hosting the Champions League final, on and on and on. You know, I think that the temptation for this will be very high. And yes, there will be some form of transparency, but it's really not driving your normal the population of soccer fans.
Andy, I hope we can talk soccer again sometime. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Andre Markovitz, professor of political science at the University of Michigan, co-author of books including Offside, Soccer, and American Exceptionalism, talking about the latest news on the FIFA, the international soccer scandals. Now we'll look at a new initiative launched at UW-Madison aimed at helping the government identify the remains of fallen American soldiers. It's called the UW-MIA Recovery and Identification Project. It'll rely on the university's history, archaeology, and forensic expertise to help recover some of the 83,000 troops missing in wars going back to World War II. Filmmaker Jed Henry's part of the team. He's with us today to tell us more about his story and the project. Jed, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
So how did this start? How did you and this UW team get involved in finding these missing soldiers?
Well, it's a long story. To make it short, I was interested in my grandfather's service in World War II. He was a native of Rocca, Wisconsin, and I started researching the unit that he served in. Like most veterans, he didn't talk much about the war, and I desperately wanted to know more about, you know, what he'd encountered and what his experience was. And as I started looking into it, I found that there was one man from his unit, a small reconnaissance unit of 199 men. They had 44 that were killed during the war, and there was one guy that was still missing. And it just seemed like there was something, you know, a piece missing from the puzzle. And so myself and a couple other volunteers, we started looking into the case. And when we got far enough along, we came to the UW-Madison because we needed help with DNA. And it didn't take long before they jumped on board to help with that case. And we were able to bring that soldier home in June of last year. And he was buried in August on the 70th anniversary of his death.
So talk through the detective steps involved in finding him or the other people you're looking for.
Well, it starts with historical analysis. And, you know, this case was a World War II case. And when you're dealing with World War II, you're dealing with fragmented records that are, you know, scattered about kind of throughout the United States in different places. Some have to be gotten through the Freedom of Information Act, which can be timely or time-consuming. But you kind of just have to go through. It's the normal detective work of trying to figure out, okay, you know, what happened to these guys? Where were they killed? Who was with them? Which area were they? And were they possibly recovered? In many cases, you know, soldiers were recovered. We have about 10,000 sets of human remains in U.S. cemeteries around the world, many of which the government refuses to even work on. And many of those could be identified through DNA if we could have access to them.
So the Department of Defense is trying to track down soldiers from past wars, but you mentioned to me before the show that World War II is not currently a priority.
Well, it's the lowest priority technically. And World War II didn't necessarily come into the mission of recovering soldiers until 2010. There was a government mandate that the accounting community or the government organizations that are in charge of finding soldiers, they had to start clearing 200 cases a year in 2015. And a year and a half ago in a congressional meeting, they said they'd be lucky to get to 125 by 2018. But they've gotten an influx of about 3 to 4 times the budget. So right now we're spending about $190 million a year to account for, on average, 74 soldiers. So it's costing about $2.5 million per identification. And the case that we did here at the University of Madison, Wisconsin-Madison, cost about $25,000.
So much cheaper than the Department of Defense is doing it. Why is it? Why is the UW well-suited to do this kind of thing?
Well, the UW is, as I'm told, one of only a handful of universities that actually have every component that's necessary to identify soldiers. When you talk about, you know, DNA, history, anthropology, it's a unique place that has everything here, and it's almost all in one building. And we have a number of experts also around the city of Madison that have all said that they would love to help. And so it's a unique place.
Now, what does this mean to a family member to have this mystery out there and maybe to have it solved and have remains brought back, or at least to know where they are?
I think it's incredibly overwhelming. Most families kind of have given up. You know, they kind of figured, well, if nothing's happened in 70 years, they're not likely to find anything out. But when you start going through this and you start gathering clues and you have a chance to actually succeed, the Gordon family that we worked with, they said they were grateful just for any information because they had gotten nothing from the U.S. government at the time of the war, after the war, and the year since. And they begged for information and never could get anything. So I think, you know, just anything is helpful.
And about how many missing soldiers are we talking about just from World War II?
In World War II, there are 73,000 missing approximately. Most people speculate that about half of those could actually be found and recovered and possibly identified.
So what's next for this project? What are you working on now to try to find more and bring this information back to families?
Well, we already have a number of cases to work. We've got a dozen cases in Europe that we're ready to move on. We're hoping to do digs in this fall. The biggest problem we have right now is funding. With the current situation at the University of Wisconsin with the budget cuts, that really hurt the program, the project. Being a new startup project here, it's hard to find the funding to do that. So, you know, we've tried to do some private donations, and we're hoping that those might possibly come in. And if they don't, we'll have to look for alternate sources.
Is there any thought, as I understand it right now, the Department of Defense isn't allowed to work with civilian groups on this. Is there hope that they might get on board and back something like this?
We'd hope so. But, you know, from the response that we've gotten, I mean, we sent something to the Department of Defense basically saying, hey, look, this program's created. We'd love to work with you, probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I've yet to even get a reply back. And considering they weren't willing to even help with the Gordon case, I'm not really optimistic. I would love to work with them, and the UW would as well, but I'm not optimistic.
All right, Jed, interesting project. Good luck going forward.
Thank you.
That's Jed Henry, part of a UW-Madison project that's helping identify remains of U.S. soldiers going back as far as World War II. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up, a provision in the proposed state budget would allow for rapid expansion of charter schools around the state. We'll find out what that means for students and local public school districts. First, women-owned businesses are being underutilized in Wisconsin. That's the conclusion of a new report from the UW-Madison Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics. While women in Wisconsin gained a lot of ground in starting and leading companies in the 1990s, since the turn of the millennium, that progress has more or less stagnated. Today, women run less than 1 in 5 Wisconsin businesses compared to about 1 in 3 nationally. Researcher Tessa Conroy suggests that in lagging the nation in women-owned businesses, Wisconsin communities are missing out on opportunities for economic growth. Tessa is a research associate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics. She joins us here in the studio. Tessa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why did you decide to look specifically at women-owned businesses here in the state?
Sure. So in this report, we're looking at women-owned businesses really within the context of community economic growth and development, and looking for where those opportunities might lie for Wisconsin. And because we see a relatively small share of women-owned businesses in Wisconsin, we think maybe that could be an opportunity for growth, for more business, for job creation, for income, as well as unique products and services that women offer.
So this isn't necessarily an issue of, or exclusively of, this is something that's bad news for women. You're concluding the report that this is bad news, it's missed opportunity for local economies.
Potentially, and I like to frame it as an opportunity. You know, there are maybe some strategies we could think about in terms of maybe making better use of our women entrepreneurs.
So I briefly touched on some of the numbers, but can you flesh that out a little for us? What did you find? What are the basic findings when it comes to women-owned businesses in the state?
Sure. So as you mentioned, about 1 in 5 businesses in Wisconsin is women-owned. That's less than the national average, which is 1 in 3. They're typically smaller than other businesses in terms of both employment and sales. So, for example, with sales, the average male-owned firm we see for every dollar, let me put it this way, for every dollar earned in a male-owned firm, a typical women-owned firm is only going to earn between 25 and 50 cents. So a pretty substantial sales gap. And in terms of employment, we're talking about, on average, 1 to 2 fewer employees in women-owned businesses.
Now, do we see a difference in the kinds of business run by men versus women?
Sure. I mean, if you were to look by industry, we see women that tend to be concentrated in different sectors. We see women in services. So that's education, that's health, that's accommodation and food services, as well as retail.
Now, why is Wisconsin below the national average? I'm sure that's a big question. I'm sure there are factors that affect everywhere, but why Wisconsin in particular?
Sure. I mean, I don't think that we really have a good sense of why that might be. We know some things that are generally true about obstacles for women entrepreneurs. Maybe those could be, you know, especially persistent in Wisconsin. For example, we know that startup finance, and as well as the financing strategy over the life of the firm, can be an issue, as an example, as well as the professional networks. You know, entrepreneurs need a lot of information. They need to be integrated and connected with the business community. And if it's the case that women don't have the relationships with important key players, they can be disadvantaged in terms of starting their venture.
Talking to Tessa Conroy from UW-Madison, a co-author of a new report on women-owned businesses in the state, opportunity for growth, she says, that could benefit a lot of local economies. Now, let's get into the obstacle side. And you're starting to touch on that there, Tessa. Networking and connections that might connect you with a mentor, with venture capital, you name it. Is that part of the problem here, that women aren't as attached to business networks as many men are?
I mean, I think certainly, even if you were to just look by the numbers, you know, kind of the surge of women entrepreneurs in recent decades suggests that there aren't a lot of older women entrepreneurs out there, maybe, that are with a lot of experience. So if I'm relatively young or new or want to start my business venture and I'm looking for a mentor or a role model who is also a woman, there aren't a lot of places to look. There's just fewer of them, fewer potential role models.
And in your recommendations for improvement, you say that's one thing to tackle. How can we as a state, I guess, build those networks?
Sure. I think that there are opportunities for, say, maybe a local chamber of commerce to develop a women business leaders association. But it doesn't have to be gender segregated by any means. Certainly integrating women entrepreneurs with the larger business community, role models, with bankers, people in the finance sector. You mentioned venture capitalists. That would certainly, has potential to help out women entrepreneurs.
And I think I saw in your recommendations to potential woman, female entrepreneurs to get involved in that kind of network. What kind of things should they be stepping forward to do there?
Sure. I mean, I think that particularly the startup financing, I mean, maybe looking into, what are the strategies of these high growth businesses? Are they right for me? What are the government-backed lending programs that might be available? And then just, you might have to be a little bit more intentional about finding those role models and those entrepreneurs. Like I said, they might be harder to find, so you might have to reach out a little bit. You might go looking.
The value there is you can avoid reinventing the wheel if you have that kind of mentorship or that kind of contact.
Yeah, or reinvent a failed wheel, so to speak. You can look at the pitfalls of past entrepreneurs and, build on and improve even on the mistakes, perhaps, or the unsuccessful strategies.
Now, another obstacle you raise in this report to women getting into starting up businesses is lifestyle. Women in general, I guess statistically, still counted on for more work at the home, more childcare, more housework. And that, you see that as an obstacle here?
I think so. I mean, this is kind of just piecing together different aspects of research, but we know that small businesses tend to be more successful when the owner puts in more hours, but we also know that women have fewer hours available because they're responsible for the majority of childcare, spousal care, elder care, and household production, basically. So there's just fewer hours in the day to devote to the business, and that could be consequential for performance.
So what's the solution there? I mean, that's a pretty ingrained cultural thing that if it's changing, it's changing very slowly.
Sure. And I think that we, potentially will continue to see cultural shifts over time. But in the meantime, maybe just communities might want to check into adequate, affordable, safe, reliable childcare options, young child development, even policies at work. I think a lot of the things that help women in organizational employment are going to have some ripple effects into self-employment and entrepreneurship.
Before we get into more obstacles and solutions, something very striking in a chart, if I read it right, I'll try to portray a visual on radio. In the 1990s, a very big rapid, it looked like, climb in women-owned businesses in the state. Around 2000, it really flattened. Any idea why that happened? Why then?
That's a great question. That's the same question I walked away with after writing the report. It's kind of what's going on there. So I think that that is kind of promising future research for those of us in this field, kind of understanding where that why that plateau is happening for women entrepreneurs.
And you also did some state-by-state charts. Are there parts of the country that are doing substantially better than Wisconsin when it comes to female business ownership?
Oftentimes you see, you know, entrepreneurs in general doing well in kind of the front range of the Rocky Mountains, right? Colorado is kind of known for its entrepreneurial culture. You see some success in the West, sometimes in parts of New England. So I think in a lot of the same places where women are continue to advance in the workplace, in the labor market, and in upper echelon of kind of leadership positions in the corporate world, you're going to also see kind of parallel advances for the entrepreneurs.
Now, one point you raise in this is the question of whether men and women have different motivations in business startups. And I know that's a huge generalization, no matter how you slice it, but a perception that men open a business, they want to make money, they're putting all their time into it. Women, in some cases, a perception that they're trying to create craft work that fits in with their lifestyle, and if they set their own hours, they can work around that. How true are those perceptions?
I mean, again, we're talking generally, and I think that we do see, you know, in kind of survey data that, for example, men are more likely to say that they started their venture as a primary source of income. You know, they're planning on being a breadwinner, whereas women are more likely to say they're doing this to accommodate a more flexible schedule, maybe so that they can also take care of children, or they're doing it as a secondary source of income. So not that that's true across the board, but that does seem to be, you know, more likely the case.
Big picture, I want to talk about the stakes here. Whether we're talking about women or men, how big a part of a state's economy, a state like Wisconsin, are startups? How important is this for the economic future of the state?
It's a big chunk. I mean, I think that if you were to look at the Great Recession, well, actually, I know this, that you saw the establishment birth rate really trail off in that
Establishment birth rate.
Right, exactly. So the number of basically new businesses on an annual basis really dropped off during the kind of 2008, 9, 10 period. And we're just now starting to get those back. So in terms of kind of economic vitality, I think that entrepreneurs and new business and the kind of ongoing dynamism of an economy are very important.
We're talking to Tessa Conroy, research associate at the UW-Madison in the Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics. Her recent report suggests that women-owned businesses are underutilized in Wisconsin. A lot of potential for growth, potentially a lot of benefit for local economies if they do grow. We'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What barriers do you see existing in the state that prevent women from starting or running businesses or growing those new businesses? Are you a woman who is a business owner or who has considered it? What resources are needed? What roadblocks are there out there for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with UW-Madison researcher Tessa Conroy about her new report suggesting that women-owned businesses are underutilized in Wisconsin, that there's potential for growth in entrepreneurship among Wisconsin women, benefits to be had for local economies if that happens. Reminder of the numbers, while women in Wisconsin gained a lot of ground in starting and leading companies in the 90s, since then, things have really flattened out. Today, women run fewer than 1 in 5 Wisconsin businesses. That compares to about 1 in 3 nationally. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a woman who's thought of starting a business or tried to do that? Do you run a business? What's your experience been? What do you think could get more women involved in running a business and creating that startup in whatever field? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our phones now. We've got Melissa on the line in Racine. Melissa, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I have a comment and a question. I'm not a woman business owner, but I am in a competitive field. And one of the things I think that keeps women from starting businesses is that you have to demystify the process. I think that there's sort of an idea that you have to have a special know-how or that kind of thing. And I think part of it is just needing a mentor or something like that to demystify the process. And my question was, is there a listing somewhere of women-owned businesses in the area or in Wisconsin so that people who want to be supportive of women-owned businesses can find those people to support.
Melissa, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take that first point first, Tessa. Demystify what doing a business startup means for women in particular, maybe for everybody. Is that part of your recommendation?
Sure. I think that that's a great point that, you know, from the outside looking in, there are a lot of unknowns if you're wanting to start a business. So like you mentioned, the role of a mentor is particularly important. So connecting with another woman entrepreneur who's more experienced certainly makes a lot of sense. I don't know about the frequency in Wisconsin, but certainly a business incubator, right, where you go into an office building, you have several kind of entrepreneurs on the cusp of startup or are in the early stages of startup, and you're all kind of learning this process together. Things like that can be a great opportunity to help, like you said, demystify the process.
And following up on her second point about where do we go to find women-owned businesses, Gigi on Facebook tells us or asks us, how is the number of businesses measured? I was recently certified, she says, as a woman-owned business. One of my customers asked me to do it, but it cost over $300 to receive that certification. So is there a place we can... That maybe is a private registry, I don't know, but where did you go to find out if a business is woman-owned?
Sure. So, I mean, I have the advantage of a great database here at the University of Wisconsin, so that's my primary resource. There's some basic information from the census and the Survey of Business Owners that we also use, but in general, in terms of kind of a registry or just learning more about women-owned business in Wisconsin, there's the Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corporation, Women's Council of Wisconsin. That could be good resources.
All right. Thanks for the comment, Gigi, and for the call, Melissa. Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Adriana in Bayfield. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just going to say that I recently started a nonprofit, and it's not necessarily maybe a women's issue, but just an issue in general that I found is there are a lot of hoops to jump through when it comes to starting a business in Wisconsin. And I have the benefit that I work at a law firm, but I just in general, we always have people coming into us asking for help starting businesses because like there are so many different things you have to hit that it can be very overwhelming. And so I think that is a barrier to small business, at least.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. So, yeah, a lot of hurdles, hoops to jump through to start a nonprofit or a business.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And I think, again, like we said, it comes back to I think a lot of people are getting their information informally. They're using their networks. They're using their connections in the business community to learn how others started their business and then mimicking those processes potentially.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Tessa Conroy about women-owned businesses in Wisconsin. There aren't enough of them, she concludes in a new report. There could be more at a benefit to the state's economy. You can join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. Now, Tessa, when I hear the phrase business startup or startup, I think my brain immediately goes to high tech.
Sure.
That's the famous stuff in Silicon Valley. Another recommendation in your report is more STEM training, science, technology, engineering, and math for women.
Certainly. I think that that's kind of one of the underlying issues, that just that there's still a gender gap in most STEM fields. And potentially that's going to correspond to the type of businesses run, the type of businesses women run or don't run down the road. So if we don't have as many women in these kind of high growth tech, high earning fields, if we're not training them in those fields, it's not very likely that they're going to start a business in those fields either. So I think continuing to encourage women in STEM, looking at, you know, what are those maybe universities or those institutions out there that are better retaining their women in STEM and seeing how they do that could be a promising long-term strategy.
Another obstacle you raise in the report is the concept that it takes money to make money. You need to pool up, find money somewhere to start the business. And we hear about the pay gap, the gender pay gap. Women get paid less than men generally. Therefore, it sounds like they have less money to start that new business than a man in a comparable industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can certainly be a compounding problem, right? Women, maybe if they are kind of disadvantaged generally financially, they're going to be disadvantaged specifically when it comes to their entrepreneurial venture. But it could be more than that, too. It could be preferences, if it's the case that maybe women just don't prefer to use bank loans or other forms of financing, or maybe they're in industries that just don't require it. Those could also be explanations for the kind of low rate or the lesser financial strategies in women-owned firms.
Mm-hmm. And generally with perception of women business owners, are they likely to, in the world we live in now, likely to get the contract that they need or the angel investment that they need? Are they taken seriously as men would be in a similar position?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, me just looking at aggregate data, it's kind of hard to tell what kind of relational disadvantages women might be facing, or kind of consumer discrimination or supplier discrimination. That's hard to quantify. But I think certainly when you look at kind of anecdotal evidence or listen to the experience of women entrepreneurs, they are still facing some of those challenges.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-123. Flora is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Flora, hi.
Hi there. I started a business in 1982 with an investment of, I think, less than $2,000, and it lasted 30 years. I owned three child care centers in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. One was licensed for 142 kids, one was licensed for 62, and one was licensed for 50. The reason that I started the child care center is exactly what you were talking about earlier. I wanted to go back to work. I had stayed home for 14 years with my two older children, and I had a two-year-old, but I needed to go to work. So why not start a child care center where I could take my two-year-old with me?
Well, and it worked out, Flora, and you ended up, what, with three centers with over 250 kids, if I did the math right. So that must have evolved into something that took a lot of your time.
Oh, it certainly did. And I always often tease that I started out wanting to take care of children and wound up running over $1 million business and did not know how I got from point A to point Z. I retired in 2011. I was lucky enough to sell my business to someone who had worked for me for 22 years, and my pension, my retirement comes from that.
Flora, thanks a lot. Congratulations on that that great business experience. Well, Flora, that's an example of the service kind of jobs that women more often, you say, tend to go into. That doesn't necessarily mean they have to be small businesses or one site or just a few employees.
Certainly. I mean, I think that, like we said, that there's a lot of diversity within women-owned businesses, and why maybe they are smaller on average, there are still great success stories. We still see women running, you know, high-growth industries. They're still perfectly capable of it. It's just a matter of kind of, you know, when we're looking at averages.
Thanks a lot for the call, Flora. Now, taking this report into the future, you said this is intended in part to help local economic planners. So what would you hope that a local community would take from this report and try to change and try to boost women-owned startups and businesses in their community?
Sure. I mean, I hope that they would maybe just start by engaging a conversation with their women business leaders and trying to understand better what their needs are or their obstacles are. You know, we've heard on the radio today about kind of how do we demystify the process. That seems to be something, an opportunity for programming or for education. I would hope that maybe a community would consider connecting or networking their women business leaders, increasing their visibility and helping them learn from one another, as well as the business community at large. What are the kind of more integrated networks that women can be a part of? And then connecting them with the financial sector. Again, that does seem to be a really important barrier for women-owned businesses. So what are the bankers, the lenders, the financiers in your community doing? Are they connected with women business leaders?
Now, a local city, say, economic planner or city council person or something like that might look at this and say, my time is finite. What's the payoff? So boost this idea. What's the payoff if they make that effort?
I think there's potential for more business. I think those businesses will employ people. So we're talking about job creation. We're talking about income and just the ways in which women might be uniquely innovative in the products and services that they're going to bring to their communities.
So what's the next step in this research into women-owned businesses here in the state?
Yeah, I think it goes back to our most recent caller, Flora. That's some work that we're looking into, kind of how does the availability of childcare relate to working women's choices? You know, are they self-employed when they have children? Is that the kind of trend that we're seeing? Or are they going back to organizational employment? We're also looking, again, at kind of can women business owners generate stability within a local economy? Are they generating growth? So kind of getting at those more macroeconomic consequences of women business leaders.
So if a potential business leader or local community leader wants to find out more or somehow participate, is there a way they can contact you, get the information, and maybe be part of the next stage of research?
Certainly. I'd love to chat. They can always contact me. But then there's also resources available. The reports that we're doing in the Department of Ag and Applied are available online.
All right, Tessa, we'll put those online. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tessa Conroy, Research Associate at UW-Madison in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, talking about her recent report suggesting that women-owned businesses have a lot of potential for growth in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your stories and experiences, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page.